The passage of scripture that will serve as the meditation for our message today is taken from the book of James. We'll be reading verses 13 through 18 in chapter 3. That's James 3, 13 through 18. And that is found on page 1012 in your pew Bibles. And when you have found that, please stand for the reading of God's holy word. This is God's holy, inspired, and infallible word as he speaks to you. Please hear it as such. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder in every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated.
I've spoken to you from this passage before, but in a different context. And this morning we're looking at how to give criticism, and tonight we're looking at how to receive criticism. When someone's wrong, and they've hurt you with their wrong, it's hard to be nice. It's hard not to act out of your frustration, act out of your hurt. When it's time to be critical, to point out someone's faults, it's easy to be harsh. One, I resent that the person has put me in a place where I have to say something to them that I don't want to have to say. Therefore, it's entirely your fault that I've got an attitude. And so you should receive what I've got to say and hear me, no matter how rude I might be, because it's your fault that I'm rude. Well, that's the way we think. It's not the truth. I'm responsible for my heart. I'm responsible for where my heart goes. And I'm told to love my neighbor as myself. Our text tells us a lot about a false wisdom and a wise wisdom. He starts by asking a question, who's wise and understanding among you? That's a hard question to answer because most of us aren't going to raise our hand and claim to be wise and understanding all the time. But when you think you're right and I am wrong, and of course, sometimes you're right that you are right and I am wrong. But when that happens, in that circumstance, you think you are wise. You think you have understanding that I don't at that moment. That happens to us all the time. Children, you sometimes think your parents are wrong. Once in a while, you're even right. Of course, we think our children are wrong at times. We think our spouse is wrong at times. Certainly the neighbors are wrong at times. We try to put up with it best we can. But when we think we're right, then we are saying, in this moment, I have wisdom and understanding. And the text tells us, by your good conduct, show your wisdom by your works and the meekness of wisdom. It says, when you're right, be meek. Don't lord it over somebody. He goes on to tell us in verse 17, the wisdom from above. So if the wisdom you have, this is, I am right and you are wrong. If that knowledge is coming from God, because it can come from other places, if that knowledge is coming from God, he says, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial, and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So I'd ask you a question. When you try to correct somebody, as a general rule, do they receive what you have to say, or does it start an argument? If it starts an argument, more often than not, you're probably not approaching it as wisely as you should. You may indeed be correct that you are right and the other person's wrong, but you're not approaching it in a way that's going to bear the fruit you're looking for. And then he gives us a section. He says, this is how you determine when the wisdom, you have to put quotations around it, the wisdom you think you have isn't from God. And so he tells us about that. And he says, in verse 14, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, now what's that talking about? A bitter jealousy. I don't like this. I'm imposing my rules. You know, the problems of life break down into three categories. There are moral issues, there are wisdom issues, and there are personal preference issues. Now, the moral issue is the only place we can bind one another. Now, that's unfortunate because I would prefer to be able to bind people in everything so they have to see things exactly the way I do. It's only right. If I'm right, they should be exactly like me. But no, life doesn't work that way. We're allowed to have differences, and nobody is wrong when those differences happen. They're just different. And so, if it's a moral issue, we can bind one another. If it's a wisdom issue, we try to convince one another. Sometimes that takes some time to do. And if it's a personal preference issue, well, if I'm asking you to agree with and practice my personal preference, aren't I asking you for a favor? And so I'm going to ask you for a favor, and I know the best way to get it. I'm going to be as rude to you as I can be, because that'll make you want to grant me the favor I'm asking. Now, when I say that, yeah, you chuckle because it sounds so ridiculous, but that's what people do. You're not doing what I think you ought to be doing when I think you ought to be doing, but it's not a moral issue. It's a personal preference issue. In my working with couples for many years, I find that's what they argue about the most. They don't have a lot of moral differences. And when they do spring up, they work past them pretty quickly because they agree to the same standard. If I can show you in Scripture that this isn't right, my experience, people are willing to admit that you're right, it's not right, and I've got to change. Wisdom issues are harder because wisdom can look different to different people. And we have to discuss it and hear each other. Sometimes it takes a number of conversations before we get on the same page. But if I'm going to pound the table and insist that you agree with my point of view on wisdom, I'm probably going to do a good job of pushing your stubborn button, which is not what I want to do. I want you to hear my argumentation in favor of this practice. And as you think about it, you're going, well, that does make sense. Yeah, that would be good. And we get on the same page. Of course, maybe you have the same thing and you're trying to convince me to see it from your point of view. We have to have patience with each other. And if it's a personal preference issue, I'm asking. And when we have bitter jealousies, I've got to get my way. It has to be the way I think it should be. And everything is treated with the strength we bring to a moral issue. It's just not right. And it says, from selfish ambition. There again. This is a self-focus. Why am I pursuing this the way I'm pursuing it? You know, in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 15, it says, but speaking the truth in love, we're to grow up in all aspects to Him who is the head, even Christ. And what's the wisdom God's telling us there? When you interact with people, do it in a way that they're conscious that you respect them, that they're conscious that they think you have value and worth, that you love them. Because when I depart from that, you quit hearing me. So this supposed wisdom that's really bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, he says in verse 15, this is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but it's earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. The three enemies of our soul. You remember we usually list them as the world, the flesh, and the devil. And he uses the terms earthly, worldly, unspiritual, so it's of the flesh, and it's demonic, of the devil. There is a wisdom, and sometimes it just grips you, and it seems so wise. I've been gripped by that false wisdom, haven't you? You can see it later. In the moment, it just owns you. And however hard I have to fight for it, it's right that I fight that way for it. Because this, a lot's at stake here. And he's warning us. No, just as other temptations have come in and got a hold of you and carried you away, the temptation to have a false wisdom can be very strong as well. It says when this happens, there's going to be jealousy, selfish ambition, there'll be disorder in every vile practice. Now the wisdom from above has a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So the wisdom from below divides us. The wisdom from above brings us closer together. How do we give criticism in a way that brings us closer together? Now, Proverbs 15 has a lot to say about this. Starting in verse 1, it says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge, but the mouth of fools pour out folly. The foolishness of a harsh criticism, my first point. It's all introduction up to this. And my goal is to fix a broken situation. My goal is not to make it worse. But I'm really, really good at making it worse. And it takes so much effort to get it right. It's hard. So my first piece of advice was, don't create a smoke screen. When you behave in a disrespectful manner, expect the person you are speaking to be respectful to you in return. You are a fool. If you get to be disrespectful to me, I get to be disrespectful back to you. Now, that's returning evil for evil, and it's wrong, and we shouldn't do it. But in those moments, I don't stop to think of my theology. Neither do you. Oftentimes, sometimes. But I follow the emotion that gets pushed. So when you speak disrespectfully to me, it seems justifiable that I speak disrespectfully back. Now, your goal is to fix something that's broken, to make the relationship work better, not worse. And so you're coming to me and say, hey, Ken, yeah, I'd like to talk to you. Oh, great. What do you want to talk about? Well, sin. Oh. Well, but you get to choose. You want to talk about your sin, or would you rather talk about mine? Whose sin am I going to choose? Now, my sin is this big. And you've come, and you're speaking harshly to me, but in comparison, your sin is this big. Whose sin am I going to want to talk about? Certainly not mine. It's a monster. I don't want to have to be confronted with that. And you give me a smoke screen. You give me a diversion. You come to me and you speak harshly, you speak disrespectfully. And from my point of view, that's the biggest sin there could ever be. Now it's self-justification and avoidance and all kinds of bad things. But that's the way it works in real life. When you give people a choice, you come wanting them to focus upon their own actions, but instead they focus upon your actions. And what do you think they'll choose? The wisdom. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Well, there it is. God's told us this. You've heard that verse many times over the years. And it's not just the answer you think, you know, I say something, and you respond gently, and that cools me down. Well, that can happen. But it happens the other way, too. You begin the conversation. Now, I kind of started the conversation by engaging in bad behavior. My behavior was my conversation starter. And you're responding to it. But you're the first one to utter some words. And when you utter words that are kind, loving, gentle, it turns away wrath. Most people tend to respond to criticism with defensiveness. Do you want to make it as hard as you can for the person you're upset with to respond in a godly manner? You know, think it through. I'm coming to you, I'm asking you to change something. Well, that's a difficult thing to do because, first of all, you have to admit you were wrong. Then you have to go to the work of changing it. So I'm asking you to humble yourself. And I'm making it as hard as I can for you to do that because right from the get-go, I'm treating you disrespectfully. And I think that's going to get you to hear me. It's foolishness. It will not happen. Do you want to leave the encounter reconciled or further estranged? Hear the word of God over and over in the scriptures. It tells us, Ephesians 4:15, rather speaking the truth in love, we're to grow up in every way into him who is the head, even Christ. Ephesians 4:31, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and slander be put away from you along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ has forgiven you. Colossians 3:12-17, put on then as God's holy ones, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another. And if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you, so also you must forgive. Above all these things, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And James 3, the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown by those who make peace. Second point is I encourage you to be humble. Remember, you might be wrong. Have you ever experienced that? Where you thought you were right, but as you discussed it with the other person, you found out you were wrong? Oh, we call that egg on your face. I don't know why that expression exists. That's something I have to look up sometime. I've heard it said since I was young, and I've learned the meaning of it. It's not something you want. I'm not quite sure why. And so we're told to take the beam out of our own eye first. The soft answer turns away wrath. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge, but the mouth of fools pours out folly. Verse 3 of Proverbs 15 tells us, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch on the evil and the good. Now, the intent of that passage is to remind us, God's in this situation. God sees the wrong that's been done. God understands the rudeness that has happened. God understands the lack of thoughtfulness or kindness that's been shown. Whatever it may be, God is there and He's involved in it. And of course, it's God's desire to show me when I'm in the wrong. But you keep getting in His way. Because you keep me focused on your bad behavior instead of focusing me on my bad behavior. It's as often happens with children. There's Johnny and he gets in a fight with his sister again. And it's an again. Johnny's just at that age and of course she goads him on some. But anyway, so he gets in a fight again and it escalates and he hits his sister. And Dad steps in and he reads him the riot act and eventually sends him to his room. Now, what I want Johnny to do is go back to his room thinking, oh, I'm dumb, dumb, dumb. I'm so dumb. Why do I do that? Dad's right. It's wrong to do that. And yes, this can be annoying sometimes, but I suppose everybody's annoying sometimes. Well, except me, but that's the way it is. But what does Johnny do? He goes, dumb, dumb, dumb. Dad's so dumb. All he can do is yell at me and holler. Scream. Because what did Dad do? He gave him the smoke screen. Perfect place to hide. Does Johnny want to admit he's wrong? Of course he doesn't. He ought to. But like any of us, our pride gets the better of us and pulls us away. God is in it. A fool despises his father's instruction, but whoever heeds reproof is prudent. In the house of the righteous there is much treasure, but trouble befalls the income of the wicked. The treasure there is not money. The treasure there is godliness, peace, relationships that work and bring joy. Those are riches that we all long for. The lips of the wise spread knowledge. Not so the hearts of fools. The sacrifice of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord, but the prayer of the upright is acceptable to Him. God is calling us to honor Him with our lips, to restore relationships, to open the eyes of the foolish and help them see and change. And so we need a plan of action. How do we put this into effect? The problem is we get into ruts. And we behave in certain ways. And over the years in our various relationships, people have pushed that button, my frustration button, my anger button, that it's kind of like my phone. Maybe it's getting old. I go to push a button, and before my finger touches the screen, it engages. I don't know, maybe just some air pressure from my finger coming close or something. It's got a hair trigger. And we can develop hair triggers. And there's certain people who have a knack of flicking that switch without hardly trying, without knowing they're doing it. And we get in these ruts and it's hard to get out. So when I'm talking to couples and they've got into that rut and they want to get out of it, they know it's not right, and they've said they want things to change, but it just hasn't worked for them. I give them a tool. I give them an offense card. Now, I have copies of it on the chairs back there. And if you want to pick up a handout afterwards, you can pick up a handout if it's something you think might be useful. And what happens? Well, it's a page of cards that are about the size of business cards. You cut them out, put some on top of your fridge, on your dresser, wherever. So they're handy. And the idea is this. When somebody does something that hurts you, upsets you, you don't just immediately approach them. It will, more often than not end well. Instead, you give them an offense card. The offense card says, "I'm sorry, it may be my fault more than yours, but I'm feeling offended." And then it has a circle in which it says, "I want to love you, I want to trust you, I want to be loved and trusted by you." And so you give the person an offense card. Now, when you receive an offense card, you say, "Thank you. I'll get back to you in a minute." Now, you're going to get back to them in a minute because you got to get over the fact that you're angry and hurt that somebody would give you an offense card. Me, Mr. Perfect, get an offense card. Where are they? I'm going to give you one back. No. You say thank you because you're thankful. Do you want to walk into a room and the first thing that happens is criticism starts flying your way? You never know if you're going to be received well or if you're going to be received harshly or unkindly. Who wants that? And so you've made a commitment. I'm not going to ambush you. If there's something I want to talk about, I'm going to give you fair warning. I'm going to give you an offense card. I'm going, "Well, that's better than the alternative, isn't it? I suppose I am thankful, aren't I, that I got an offense card." It also gives you a minute to steel yourself. Okay, I'm going to go back. We're going to talk. And there's going to be some criticism. And I'm ready for it. I'm not going to blow up. I'm going to hear it out. And if the criticism is just, I want to respond to it rightly. So I've got my mindset on. Now my theology is part of my mindset, not just my emotions. And so a couple minutes, I come back and say, "Well, you gave me an offense card, and I want to talk to you about it." And it starts getting off. You see, every offense is caused by the same cause. Not the best sentence in the world. Anyway, the cause of every offense is always the same. There are thousands and thousands of things, situations in life that can cause an offense, but the actual cause is always the same. An offense is caused by a perceived lack of love. Now, you could change it as a perceived lack of respect, perceived lack of kindness. It's a lack of love. So when you're sitting at the stoplight and it turns green, the person in front of you is playing on their phone and they don't go, most of us are a little offended by that. You know, go park and play on your phone. It's time to drive. No, I'm going to play on my phone in traffic. We don't approve of that. And why? It's just the common respect that we show one another as we're sharing the road is not being shown. It's a lack of love. It happens in many ways, in many circumstances. Now, I've done something that's offended you, and you give me the card, and I come back, and I say, thank you for giving me the card. I love you. I hate it when I do something that hurts you, but I obviously have, so we need to talk about it. Well, half the problem's already solved. Why? Because you restate your love. You assure the person, you are important to me. You matter to me. And why were they offended? Because something happened that called that into question. And even if, as you discuss it, and you find out the other person interpreted the situation wrongly, and there was no need to take offense, aren't you glad they didn't live with that perceived offense? That there was the opportunity to straighten things up so they're certain about your love and devotion to them? Because your love and devotion to them is real. Now, that's the first tool I give them. The second tool I give them is rules for a conference table discussion. Those rules are on the back table too. I'm going to run through them very quickly with you. Sometimes we have lost the ability to solve problems, to talk to each other. And we've fallen into the bad habit of venting at each other. So I will tell you things I'm upset about. And then when I pause to take a breath, you begin to tell me things you're upset about. The problems never get addressed. Nothing ever gets fixed. But from time to time, we vent upon each other. And because of the emotional experience of venting, I feel better afterwards. But nothing gets fixed. And we just do it again and again. We're going, you have to stop that bad habit that you've fallen into. You never planned for it to be there, but it happened. And you have to start speaking to each other. Now, the Bible gives us many, many directions on how to speak to each other, but we frequently don't have a plan about how we're going to put those into effect. James chapter 1, verse 19 and 20 says, this you know, my beloved brethren, let everyone be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger, for the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. And so we take those three criteria. We want to be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. And we have six rules on how we're going to make that actually happen. And when it happens, people work through their problems more often than not. So we start with prayer. Husbands, I usually ask you to open with prayer. If you're doing it with your kids, mom, you open with prayer. You can get it wrong all on your own. You're going to need God's help to get it right. Rule number two, participants may not speak unless they're holding a talking tool. We're very legalistic with this. We're going to clearly define whose turn it is to talk and whose turn it is to listen, and we obey it. When it's your turn to listen, no grunts, groans, eye rolling, head shakes. You listen respectfully. Period. When it's your turn to talk, you have to talk. That's good because some people don't want to talk when they ought to talk, but they have to. And we have a conversation with each other. Now, a talking tool is any object recognized by both parties to represent that purpose, a pen, a knick-knack. Guns, knives, baseball bats, and pillows don't make good talking tools. And I've had people use all of those. And can you just imagine, you know, well, why don't we just use my handgun for a talking tool? And you go first, and there she is, pointing the gun. I'd get unsettled pretty quickly. They found that out, but they shared it with me, and they moved on to a pen. Sometimes people just don't think ahead. Generally, you don't keep talking to them for longer than 3 minutes. We want to have a conversation. I speak a paragraph. You respond with a paragraph. It goes back and forth. It's not for venting. Now, the listener has to have pen and paper and take notes as they listen. See, what happens is you're talking to me, and you tell an outright lie, a gross exaggeration, or something that I think is very unkind, and I can't let it go unchallenged. And it might get lost in our conversation, and so it's my duty to interrupt you. Normally, it would be rude to interrupt you, but in this case, it's not. Yeah, it is. But that's how we think of it. And so we're saying, no, I may not, but I have my pen and paper, and I jot down a note. Always late. Back in 2018, I was on time. But I got to go that far back. It's probably not that gross an exaggeration, and you should just receive it. Number four, if the listener believes the speaker is speaking with harshness or other ways that make listening difficult, the listener simply stands up. The speaker must apologize and promise to speak with greater kindness. This how we keep the agreement. I will talk with you about anything you want to talk about. There's some things I'd rather not, but if you want to, I will. But I want it to stay respectful. And so if somebody's not aware that they're getting a little heated, the listener can stand up. When that happens, the speaker has to say, "I'm sorry, please sit down. Thanks for letting me know. I'll try harder to speak with kindness." One of two things happens. One, when the person stands up, the speaker listens to themselves and they go, "Oh, I was getting a little hot there." And because they hear it, they know how to fix it. Sometimes somebody stands up and they say the prescribed script, "Thank you for letting me know. Please sit down. I'll try harder to speak with kindness." And they don't know what to do because there's absolutely nothing wrong with the way they were talking. That's what their ears are telling them. It's not true, but it's what their ears are telling them. I say, okay, you do two things. You lower your volume and you smile. It's hard to have ugly attitudes when you smile. And speak with a little less volume so that your trying is recognized. Rule number five, if an issue is discussed for 10, 15 minutes, no progress is being made, the issue should be tabled, temporarily set aside. It's going to lead to an argument eventually if you keep pushing it. There's no sense in taking it to an argument. It can be brought up later, or you can bring it up with a third party. If either party requests an issue be delayed until a third party can be involved, it should be honored. Now, when you want to talk about something and I don't, and you make me talk about it, does that ever go well? Which doesn't stop me from doing it. Maybe this time it will go well. Now, you see, you're caught in the emotion. I'm hurt by this. This is important. I want to fix this. It's got to be fixed right now. It's obvious it's not going to be. Maybe both of you need to cool off some and have a discussion later. The sixth rule, very easy. When agreement is reached, you write it out and both parties sign it. One of the two, usually the wife is the secretary, will offer to write it out. When you write it out, you skip every other line. That leaves room for edits. The other person reads it. Could we change this word? Could we add this phrase? You get it to a form that everybody agrees with. You sign it. Now we don't have to argue whether we ever had this discussion or not. It's there. We've got a record. It helps us take it seriously. So I encourage couples to get three notebooks. I like spiral-bound notebooks. Slide a pen down the spine of each notebook. Now you're ready for your conference table talks. Each one gets a notebook to take notes in as they listen. The third notebook serves two purposes. In the front, you record your lasting decisions. In the back, you record your table discussions. And you begin working through the problems of life and resolving them. And life gets better. That's the biblical pattern. That's what we see Paul practicing in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Now, Paul comes to rebuke the church at Corinth, but also to remind them of God's love. Verse 17 says, "But in the following instructions, I do not commend you, because when you come together, it's not for the better, but for the worse. In the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear there are divisions among you. And I believe it in part, for there must be factions among you in order that those who are genuine among you may be recognized. When you come together, it's not the Lord's Supper that you eat. For in eating, each one goes ahead with his own meal. One goes hungry, another gets drunk." What? Do you not have houses to eat and to drink in? Or you despise the church of God and humiliate those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I commend you for this? No, I will not. God comes to us sometimes and he rebukes us. But he doesn't stop there. God's come to us and says, there's a truth about you I want you to know. Every single last one of you, children, you too, you have sinned and you come short of the glory of God. And there's judgment awaiting you. But there's good news. Christ has suffered the penalty of sinners. And you can turn and trust in him. and find comfort for your souls, a place to hide from the wrath of God, and a new life that will allow you to live more righteously towards your Creator. It's all bound together. And so Paul goes on to say, "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you. The Lord Jesus, the night when he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, he also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is a new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.' As often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes." He says, we've been given this sacrament to always bring us back to the basics. It's not how good I am. It's not how successful my life is going. It's that Christ loved me and gave himself for me. And that is the basis for my peace with God. And I can come and confess sin as often as necessary, and the Lord's love does not change. And as we come to partake of the Lord's Supper together this morning, we should be aware of that and rejoice in it, despite things going on in our life. But he goes on to remind them, in the context in which they were not eating the bread and drinking the cup in a worthy manner, he says, "Whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. That is why many of you are weak and ill, and some have even died. But if we judge ourselves truly, we will not be judged. But when we are judged by the Lord, we are disciplined, so that we may not be condemned along with the world. So then, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, so that when you come together, it will not be for judgment. About the other things, I will give direction when I come." Some things are best discussed face to face. You know, so many couples conduct their relationship through texting. It really doesn't work well. You text me a message, and I can put whatever vocal inflection on it I want. And if I'm in a bad mood, I'll put a bad vocal inflection on it, and you will be a bad person for sending such a text to me. And so I'll fire one back at you. And you didn't mean it the way I took it, and now you're offended that I'm supposing evil things about you. And so you fire off one at me, which proves the first one was right in my interpretation, because now you are ticked. And boom, 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 boom. Text about essential things. Grab some milk on the way home, please. Okay, I can do that. If there are problems, don't text about them. It'll blow up in your face and the problems will get bigger. We need to hear each other's voices. When possible, we need to be face to face. And so it's our joy to continue our worship this morning by coming to the Lord's table. He has disciplined us. He has rebuked us. Every day he convicts you of sin and righteousness. And he says, but I don't want you to forget this. I want you to remember that I love you dearly. And that's why we come to the table and say, Lord, for all the times you've rebuked me, those times when you've disciplined me because of my stubbornness and hardness of heart, I'll not lose this. I believe you dearly love me. And we'll celebrate that as we come to the table. But first, let's join together in singing, Take Time to Be Holy, number 537.